Hello, everybody. Welcome to our first section, which we're going to be discussing mobile web development. So just a few announcements. In case you haven't checked out the course website already, all the lectures will be available at cs76.net/lectures. Should be available within 72 hours of their filming, as will all of these sections. You can check out more information at cs76.net/sections for both the schedule, and there'll be section videos posted there really soon. So today, we're going to be focusing on mobile web development, so we're going to learn some more mobile HTML tricks, as well as look at a few WebKit CSS 3 features in more detail. We're going to have a more detailed introduction to JavaScript, its syntax, and some cool things you can do with it. We're going to take a look at jQuery a little more than we did in lecture. And finally, mobile DOM events. So these are special JavaScript events that work just on touch devices, and we can use them to create some really cool effects. So just so everyone knows, there is a page on my website where you can give me some anonymous feedback, like, you talk too fast, or I really wish you'd do something else. So everything is totally anonymous, so feel free to submit something after this section, and I'll definitely try to incorporate it into my teaching, and we'll all be happier. So during lecture, we took a look at these things called meta tags. So mobile browsers, they do their best to display all content, which may be huge, on their little tiny screen. However, if we're designing pages optimized for these small screens, we don't want them to try to do that. So we need to let the browser know that we are on a mobile device. We've already optimized our site for a mobile device via these meta tags. So one of these tags is not a meta tag. It's actually the link tag we can use to give our app its own icon when it's added to the home screen. So if we say link rel equals Apple Touch icon, then we can just give a path to an image file somewhere on our server, and that's going to be the app's icon if someone adds it to the home screen. So we can say link rel equals Apple Touch icon, then give it an href and give it a path to some image on our server. So for iPhones, the default icon size is 57 by 57 pixels. And when you add an app to the home screen, you might notice that Apple does this nice little gloss effect. So it kind of goes along with all the other apps on your iPhone. Now, if you don't want that effect to be applied to your icon automatically, which is what's going to happen with this first tag, you can just change the rel to Apple Touch icon precomposed, which says, OK, when you add this to the home screen, please don't put any gloss effects over it. I worked really hard on my icon, and I want you to display it as it actually looks. So some other meta tags we looked at, the first being the viewport. So here, we can set the viewport to be the width of the device. However, on a lot of mobile web pages, the way people navigate around is with pinch zoom. You know, if there's a large page, you can pinch in and out to zoom in on certain parts of the page or view the whole page at once. Now, if your site's optimized for a mobile device, you might not want that to happen, because as soon as the user zooms out, your entire page breaks because you designed it for that specific device width. So if you add in this user-scalable equals no, whenever the user tries to pinch zoom on their page, nothing's going to happen. So another meta tag we looked at was the Apple mobile web app capable. So if we say content equals yes, what that's going to do is it's going to hide the address bar until the user... Actually, that's actually going to hide the address bar entirely. So if the user adds your app to the home screen, then they launch it from the home screen, there's going to be no address bar, and so they're not even going to realize that they're looking at a web app. Remember, if you're going to do this, because you're hiding all the browser controls, there's no more back button, so make sure your entire web app is fully navigable without having to rely on bookmarks or the back or forward button. Finally, we have the Apple mobile web app status bar style, which is very verbose, as all Apple things are, as we'll learn once we look at iOS. So here, we can change the color of the status bar. So by default, you know, when you're on your home screen, you have that silver bar at the top of your iPhone that says the time and the signal strength. We can actually change its color, so maybe it matches the background of our app or something. So here, we'll set it equal to black, and the clock will automatically switch to a silver font, and it'll look really cool. So a few more tricks to make your web app look cooler that aren't necessarily HTML, but more WebKit CSS. So as we mentioned in lecture, sometimes we don't want something on the page to be selectable. So we were looking at all these frameworks, and you'll notice at the top they have this header. Now, if the user tries to highlight that header, these frameworks are not going to highlight it by default, because if you're on an app and you like hold the top of the app, you don't want a big highlight copy-paste dialog to occur. So if we say WebKit user select equals none, that's going to prevent the user from selecting any text that really shouldn't be selectable, or you know, the user would never need to copy and paste. Also, if you hold down something on an iPhone, Or, so if you have an image on a web app and you touch and you hold that image, there's going to be a little pop-up at the bottom of your iPhone that's going to come up and it's going to say something like copy this image or save this image or email this or something else you don't want to happen. So we can also disable that. So if we say WebKit touch callout equals none, whenever the user touches and holds on an element, that dialog is never going to appear and annoy you. Finally, if you want to remove that highlight when they click a button or an image. So you'll notice in lecture on some of the demos, when we clicked on something, there was this gray highlight that came up on an iPhone. It's green on most Android devices. And if that doesn't really match our theme, we don't want that to happen. You know, maybe we want it to highlight blue. So using this WebKit tap highlight color, we can customize the color that highlights any element we select on the page. So here, I've just set it equal to nothing. So we're using the CSS3 RGBA, where it's red, green, blue, alpha. So here, we're setting everything to zero, which means no color is going to pop up when someone taps on any element. So any questions on cool things we can do to optimize our web apps? Sure. Oh, so WebKit is what's called a layout engine. So it's actually used by both Chrome and Safari. So this will actually do the same thing on both an iPhone and an Android device. Windows 7 phone, unfortunately, probably doesn't support it yet. But as CSS3 becomes more adopted by everyone, you won't even have to have this WebKit. You could just say something like tap highlight color. But right now, this will work on both Android and iOS devices because they both use WebKit, as does the desktop browsers Safari and Chrome. So feel free to ask me tons of questions. Even as I'm talking, that's kind of the purpose of the section, is so that you can get some more interaction. So other than make sure our browser doesn't do anything annoying while people are trying to use our web app, we can actually do some really cool stuff with this CSS3. So the first, and possibly my favorite, is the WebKit gradient. And so this looks daunting at first because there's all these arguments, but it's pretty easy to understand. So the first is going to be the type of gradient. So your choices are basically linear, in which case one color is going to fade into the next color, or radial, in which case you're going to have a circle in the middle, and then the colors are going to change outwards from the circle. So your gradient has to have a start and an end point. So in this example, we're starting at the top left of the image, and we're going to end at the bottom left of the image. So this gradient is going to be like a top-to-down gradient. And now the colors are going to be the from and to arguments. So we're going to say from CCC, which is a light gray, to 999, which is a darker gray. So this WebKit gradient is, without any images at all, is going to create a nice gradient top to bottom from a light gray to a darker gray. So on a lot of mobile devices, it's really popular to have these rounded corners. So to do that, as we looked at in lecture, we're going to use WebKit border radius. And so this takes four arguments, if you want to call them. So they're going to be the top, right, bottom, and the left. So if you want to have a totally rounded border, you can say something like WebKit border radius 10 pixels. And if you only give one number, it's going to know to just say, OK, they obviously want the top, right, bottom, and the left to all be 10 pixels. So if you just wanted something in the top, you would have to say something like 8000. There's also this WebKit border top left radius, which is more verbose, but in case you don't want to remember the order of those arguments, you can just use that. So CSS transforms are really, really cool. So this allows you to take an element on the page. It could be an image, it could be text, and we can transform it. So we can rotate it by 45 degrees. That's what the DEG is. You could also do radians if you're more math inclined. We can also skew the image. We can translate it. So this would be the same as, you know, moving it just straight left to right in the page. Or, for the really math inclined, we can multiply it by a transformation matrix. And so this is just a skew matrix. So you're going to multiply it by a 4x4 matrix, and these last two arguments are going to be your translation. So if you want to combine a skew and a rotate and a translation, you can do it all by just multiplying it by this matrix. But that's only for the linear algebraically inclined among us. So animations. So previously, the way to animate things on the page, to make things move around, was to use pure JavaScript. So that's all well and good, but now we can do it using CSS3. So the property is called WebKit Transform, and it's going to take three arguments. The first is going to be the properties that you want to be animated. So if we just say all, any properties that change on this element are going to be automatically animated for us. The second is a duration. You can say something like 1s for 1 second or 100 ms for 100 milliseconds. And finally, we have a function. So you don't have to write your own function. It already has all these built-in functions for you. So if you want to animate something linearly, you know, just left to right, everything at the same speed, you'd say linear. If you want to ease in and out, so it's going to start off fast and then kind of slow down as the animation finishes, you want to say ease in and out. Or if you want a function that's going to start off really fast, then slow down in the middle, and then finish off really fast, you can say a cubic Bezier. And so now, this is going to be applied on the element that's going to be animated. So after we apply this WebKit transition property, any style attribute that changes on that element after this is going to be automatically animated. And these aren't just limited to the CSS3 things we've looked at. If we just change something like the color or the background color of the element, it's going to be automatically animated for us, which is really, really cool. And so another cool effect that you can achieve in your web apps is that kind of inset text look that you see in your iPhone. You know, there's like a black background, and then there's some text, and it looks like that text is kind of going into the background. So that's actually not as impressive as it looks. All that's done using just a text shadow. And so text shadow is going to take four arguments. The first is going to be the x and y. First two are going to be the x and y coordinates of the shadow, so where the shadow is going to start relative to whatever the text you're shadowing. The third argument is going to be the blur of the shadow. So if you want to have a really large shadow that kind of disperses as it gets far away from the text, you're going to want a high number here. Or if you just want a really tight shadow that goes right along the outline of the text, you're going to have a smaller argument here. And finally, just the color of the shadow. So to achieve that inset text look, if you have text on a light background, you want your offsets to be positive, and you want to use a whitish color. If you want inset text on a dark background, you're going to use negative offsets and a black-ish color. So here, I have positive offsets and a white-ish color. So this could be used to make some light text or some any color text on a light background appear to be inset. So I have a page here with some examples. I have a low battery. So we can take a look at the code for this. So here I have 1, 2, 3, 4 elements on the page that are all just divs, each with a different class. So the first of these, I gave it a class of border. And here you can see I'm using the border radius property. Here I've just set it to 10 pixels. So as you can see, this div has a border of 10 pixels. And I'm also using a gradient here. So I'm using the gradient that I described on the slides, where I'm going from this lighter gray color to this darker gray color from top to bottom. So this next box is rotated. So I'm using the WebKit transform. And here I'm rotating it 45 degrees. And we can also set an origin that we're rotating around. And so I've set the origin at the bottom left, just so that the element doesn't. So the element starts rotating based on that bottom left corner. And as you can see, that's what happened. Right now, our bottom left corner is on the left side because we rotated that direction. So this third div here is skewed. So I've used WebKit transform, and I've given it a skew of negative 45 degrees, which says I'm going to skew it to the right. Again, my origin is in the bottom left. And this margin top is just so that it doesn't crash into the little box above it, because the box is rotated and this is skewed. They would overlap if I didn't do that. So finally, my favorite one is this spin block. And so what the spin block is going to do is we have a WebKit transition here. So here we're going to animate every property. The animation is going to take 1 second, and we're using the ease in out function, which means we're going to start off slow, get fast in the middle, and then we're going to finish slowly. So when I tap this element, what I'm doing, we're going to look at this is jQuery, which we're going to look at very briefly. But what this basically says is that when I tap this element, I'm going to apply a new CSS rule to this element. And this new CSS rule is going to be a WebKit transform. Now I'm going to scale it by 2, I'm going to rotate it 720 degrees, and I'm going to move it over to the right. So that's all one CSS rule. That's going to be everything I did with WebKit Transform. And I'm going to change the background color of this element to green. So what happens when I touch this is my iPod battery doesn't die. Now, when I touch this element, brace yourself, it's going to spin up and turn to green. Now, all of that is completely without JavaScript, barring the touch event, but that's all using just CSS. Okay. So that animation, once again, is going to look like that. So I touch it, spins 720 degrees, goes over to the right, and it actually animated that background color, which is pretty cool. So now we are all done with CSS for the moment, and we're going to take a look at JavaScript. So I am extremely biased because I love JavaScript. It's my favorite programming language. And if anyone ever tells you that it's a bad language or that it's just a toy, they're wrong. So just a brief intro to JavaScript. It's a client-side scripting language. So you might have seen root languages like PHP, Ruby, or Python. And those are all server-side, which means that code is going to execute on the web server. It's going to create some output file, and that's going to be sent to the browser. JavaScript, on the other hand, is going to execute on your web browser. So server-side code is on the server. Your browser never sees it. JavaScript, your browser is actually what's executing it. So it's also a scripting language like Python and Ruby. You don't have to worry about compiling it for 6 hours or worrying about types. However, JavaScript is not Java. This is a very common misconception. But JavaScript was actually named by Netscape right after they added Java support. And so they wanted to make it look like this cool, new, trendy thing. So they named it JavaScript because everybody recognized the Java word. So it's just like they tried to make Greenland more appealing, even though it's really cold. So JavaScript syntax, which we've seen in lecture, is really similar to C and PHP. You have your basic if-else constructs. You have a for loop. You have a while loop. Strings are built in, which is unlike C. But just like Java, you have a built-in string. You don't have to worry about character arrays. And unlike PHP, variables don't need dollar signs because the dollar sign is a valid character you can have in your variable. So here we can see that neither functions nor variables have types. If we want to create an integer x, we just say x equals 5. We know int x equals 5 or x colon int equals 5. And creating a new function that returns an integer is as simple as saying function increment x, and then we're just going to return incremented x. So JavaScript scope is a bit different from a lot of other languages. So this var keyword is what establishes a JavaScript variable's scope. So if you say something like var x equals 5, that's going to limit the scope of x to the current function that you're executing. Without this var, that x is automatically going to be a global variable. So that's just something to keep in mind when you're designing your web apps. If you forget that var somewhere, you may get unexpected values of variables in places. So just remember that the var is what establishes scope. So there are a few ways to get JavaScript onto your page. Using the script tag, you can load an external script from somewhere on your page or somewhere on some other site on the internet. We're going to say script. We're going to say the type is text/JavaScript. And then we're going to use the src attribute for source to establish the path to the JavaScript file. So if I just say script.js, it's going to look in the current directory of my web server for a JavaScript file called script. I could also say google.com/google.js or whatever it is they're using. And I would automatically load a JavaScript file from their servers. So this script tag behaves differently depending where you put it in your HTML. So if you put the script tag inside of the head, the entire thing is going to be evaluated before the page loads. So that's something to keep in mind. Like if you're doing something like counting the number of images on your page and you try to count them before the images have loaded, it's not going to work so well. If you put the script inside of your body tag, it's going to be evaluated in the order that it occurs. So if there are images above it, then it'll find those. But if there are images below it, then it's not going to find those. So generally, if we're writing JavaScript for web apps, we want to put all of our JavaScript in the head and then call an event handler when the page is finished loading so we know we have all those elements. So we're going to take a look at how to do that in just a moment. So arrays are really common, definitely something to take a look at. So as we looked at in lecture, declaring an array is super easy. We just say var numbers equals, it could either be a blank array or we can populate it with some values. JavaScript arrays can contain multiple different types. Here I have ints, a string, and a float. That's no problem. And so a few array functions we can look at. To add a new element to the array, you're going to call numbers.push. So my array is called numbers. It has a lot of functions built in because it's basically an array object. So we can push, and then we can specify the element we want to be added to the end of the array. If we want to remove and return the first element of the array, we can say numbers.shift. And so that will return the value 1, and the array will now be 2, 3, 4, 5.3. If we want to do the same thing with the last element of the array, we can say numbers.pop, and so that would return 6, and the array would be 2, 3, 4, 5.3. If you want to remove specific elements from the array, JavaScript has a built-in delete keyword, or we can just use array.slice, where the first argument is going to be the index in the array, and the second argument is going to be the number of things that we slice. So in addition to arrays, JavaScript has hash tables, also called objects. So the syntax is very similar to an array, except we're using these braces instead of brackets. So hash table is a key-value pair. We can have our key. The quotes here are actually optional. It's generally good style, and you can have something like a hyphen inside of your key if you use quotes, but obviously you can't if you don't use quotes. So we have key-value. If you want to insert a new value into our hash table, we can just address it with its key and set that key equal to a value, and that will now be added to our hash table. So hash tables are also objects, and they have an interchangeable syntax. So if I declare this same hash table, I can add a key using a different syntax. We can just say object.occupation, and that's going to do the same thing as this, because in JavaScript, hash tables are just objects, and the syntax is totally interchangeable. Now we can even add functions to our object, and now we can create what you'd consider an object in a more traditional language. So if we add a function called grade that just alerts done, because I'm a really fast grader, we can call that with tf.grade, and that's going to alert done. So that's the syntax for creating objects in JavaScript. So scripting languages like Python and PHP, there's this for in loop, which makes iterating over a hash table really easy. So if I say for I in TF, I can iterate through this hash table. Now, a little bit that different from some other languages is I is going to be the key, TF is going to be the array. So I can't just say alert I is, or I'm just going to alert, so if I alert I, that's the key. So in some languages, this for in loop, the I would be the values, and you'd have to specify that I want the keys, not the values. In JavaScript, I is the keys. So if I want to access all of the keys and values from a JavaScript array, I can alert the index and then the value at that index. And so we cannot use numbers to index hash tables. So TF0 doesn't mean anything. If we want to get all the keys in a hash table, we should use this for in loop. So any questions so far? Okay. So one more thing. So if you remember from lecture, those meta tags were really cool if someone adds it to your home screen, right? So we just looked at a page that had all those meta tags, and you'll notice that I still have low battery, and I still have an address bar. So I still have this address bar here. So when I load the page, you know, I still get this address bar, and I'm very aware that I'm still browsing the web. If we don't want to do that, we can use this cool little JavaScript trick. So as soon as the page loads, all we have to do is scroll the page a little bit and watch what's going to happen. So if we open up our WebKit CSS file, in here, we'll go over this briefly, but basically this is the code that's executing as soon as the page is finished loading. So we're adding this set timeout, which means that this code is going to be executed after 100 milliseconds. So we're not doing it immediately just because that would confuse the user because there'd suddenly be no address bar. If we wait 100 milliseconds, it's going to do this cool slide-up thing. So we're just going to scroll the window a little bit, and Safari is going to be so kind as to hide the address bar for us. So if we save this page, now, if we refresh this page, and I have the document camera on, so now as soon as we refresh this page, our address bar goes away. Really cool feature that uses JavaScript and not those meta tags.
So all it did was shift it down? If you pushed it with your finger, you would find the address bar?
Yeah, so if I scroll back up, the address bar is right there. But you could do something like detect if the user is at the top of the page, and if they are, just scroll them back down a little bit, in which case the address bar will go away again. But this is just to prevent the confusion of, so I have this web app, and as we looked at in lecture, we have like a title bar, right? And it said something like header. And the way it was styled actually looked a lot like this address bar, the background. And so it would be really confusing for the user if suddenly there were these two similar background things, and they wouldn't really know like where they were or what to do. And it's also kind of a waste of screen real estate that we could gain if this weren't here. So that's kind of the purpose of that cool trick. Any other questions? Cool. So now we're going to take an in-depth look at jQuery. And so this is the JavaScript library that powers jQuery Mobile, jQtouch, and a lot on the web. So jQuery is MIT GPL licensed, so it's totally free. And you can download it at jQuery.com. However, I would recommend that you do not download it and then host it on your own server and link to that. Instead, you want to just use a hosted copy on, you know, Google hosts a copy for you, jQuery hosts a copy for you. And the reason for that is because a lot of websites use this copy on Google or another site. And so what your web browser is going to do is cache that. And so it's not going to have to download it again. If, however, you put it on your own server, unless everyone's visiting your website and caching that copy, you're going to have the browser going to have to download it again, and you're going to incur some loading time. So in lecture today, we looked at this document.getElementById thing. And so not only is that a really long function name, there's really not a lot it can do other than get an element by ID. And so jQuery's most important function, I would say, addresses this. And so this function is the $ function. And so it allows you to select elements on the page using CSS selectors. You can select multiple elements, one element, and you can say exactly what elements on the page you want to select, not just, you know, selecting one element by a single ID. So let's look at a couple examples of this. So if I want to select all of the P elements on the page, so P being the paragraph tag, I would say $ and then in quotes, P. And so that's going to be the tag that I want to select, and I now have all of my paragraph tags. Now, if I want to select everything with a specific class, I can say image.logo, which is going to select everything with the tag image and the class logo. So if instead of class, I want to select by ID, I use this hash and then the ID of the element. So if somewhere on my page, I have something like div ID equals hash navbar. Now, if I want to select everything except that, I could say $, then this colon not operator, which is going to select everything on the page except anything with an ID of navbar. And so finally, if we have this list, say we have our web app and we have a navigation list, and we want every other thing on that navigation list to be colored differently or have a different animation or something. So to select every other element in that list, we can use the nth child. So here you can say even odd to select all the even or odd elements, or you can give it a specific number. So if I say nth child 2, I'm going to select the second element in the list. Keep in mind that this is one indexed, so it's not zero indexed. So if you're iterating through a loop and you're trying to select the zeroth child, nothing's going to happen. So you need to make sure that the first child is actually an nth child of 1. So jQuery event handling. So web apps are really event driven. You know, users are going to do something on your page, and you want to respond to what they do. So the jQuery bind function allows you to attach event handlers to certain events on elements. So the first thing you're going to do is select all the elements you want to add an event handler to. So in this case, I'm selecting all of the image elements, not just, you know, the first image element or something like that. I have all my images. So now I'm calling bind on that collection. So the first argument to bind is going to be the event that I'm binding a handler to. So in this case, we're going to say click. So the second argument to this function is going to be the event handler. So in this case, we want to say you clicked an image every time a user clicks an image on the page, because that's not annoying. So jQuery can also be used to manipulate the DOM. So this could add or remove content from your page. So if we have a collection of elements or a single element, and we call the after function, we can add some content after every single one of those elements. So if we had a bunch of paragraphs, we realized that we wanted to end every paragraph with like a little box or something, we could just select all the P's and say after, and then this content would just be the string of whatever it is you wanted to add to the end of every paragraph. Just like after, we have before. So this is going to be add all the content before the selected elements. And there's also this function called append, which looks a lot like after, but actually behaves differently. So if we selected all these paragraph tags and called after, whatever content we gave it is going to be added after the closing P tag. So if we wanted to append, you wanted to say, you know, add a div after the P closes, we'd use after. If, however, we wanted to add something inside of those P tags, we would use append. So if we say P and then append some content, that's going to go inside of the paragraph tags instead of outside. So we can also remove elements from the page using the remove function. So we can just select the elements you want to remove and call remove on those. Or we can show and hide them. So this is equivalent to changing the CSS to the CSS display property to none or block. And these functions also take an argument that allows you to fade images in and out. So if we say show quotes medium, that's going to fade in the element at a medium pace. We can also give it a number, and that's going to be the milliseconds it takes for the animation to complete. So this was kind of pre-CSS3 animations, but certainly still very handy. So jQuery also allows you to manipulate the CSS of an element. So in pure JavaScript, we have this style property of an element. And this style property is just going to be a string of all the styles applied to that single element. So because parsing that whole thing would be really annoying, you know, to change the value, you'd have to find the appropriate rule and then change the value. We can just use this CSS function, which allows you to get and set multiple rules at the same time. So it takes when setting, it takes a single argument, and it's going to be an object representing all of the CSS attributes you want to change. So the key in this object is going to be the rule. So here I'm changing the color and the background. Now the value of everything is going to be what you're changing it to. So now to retrieve the value of some CSS attribute, we're just going to call it using a string, and we're going to say what attribute we want to get the value of. So after I called the CSS and I set the color to red, if I then just called CSS on the string color, it's going to give me back red. So we also have these add and remove class functions. So here we can add or remove a CSS class from an element. So remember that element should have one unique ID, but can have multiple classes. So if you have a special class for a button after someone taps it, you could just add the class after they tap the button. And there's also this has class function, which will return, which takes a single argument, and that's going to be the class you're checking for, and it's going to return true or false, you know, whether or not that element has the class that you're asking it for. So today we also looked at Ajax, and we looked at how jQuery would make that even easier. So here I actually have an even shorter example than we had in lecture, because jQuery provides this $.ajax function, and that's kind of the universal, you know, lots of different things you can do with Ajax. But for our purposes, we're probably not going to be doing some really complicated Ajax request. Most of the time, we just want to get some content for some page. So we want to send out an HTTP GET request to some page and then parse whatever it sends back. So if we just say $.get, the first argument is just going to be a string, and that's the URL that you're sending the Ajax request to. And the second argument is going to be that event handler that's going to fire as soon as the request was successful. So here, if page.php is going to return some string, I'm just going to alert it as soon as the AJAX succeeds. So if instead of sending a GET request, you wanted to send a POST request, you would just say POST to the URL, and you can specify your POST data, and then have that same callback function. So I have a quick example of things you can do with jQuery. And this font is too small again. OK, so here we are loading the jQuery library. So notice I'm not hosting this on my own page. I'm just linking to code.jquery.com/whatever version of jQuery I'm using. This is actually technically outdated because jQuery 1.5 was released a couple days ago. So here I want this code to execute as soon as my page finishes loading. So jQuery provides this ready event handler. So I'm going to select the entire document. So we're selecting by the JavaScript document object, as in document.getElementById. So if we attach the ready event to the document, this is going to fire once all the DOM has loaded and everything is parsed and we're good to go. You'll notice, however, that this is still in the head of my page. So this isn't in the body. So this is going to be executed when the page loads. So as soon as the page loads, we're going to say, OK, page, when you're actually done loading, come back and fire this function, but don't fire it right now. So on this page, I have three paragraphs with an IDs of 1, 2, 3, or 4. So if we select each of these paragraphs, so when I click, which is analogous to tap on a mobile device, the first paragraph is going to hide. But because I've given it this slow argument, it's actually going to fade out slowly. The second, the CSS is going to be changed. So I'm changing the color to red and the background to black. The third, I'm adding a new class and removing a new class. So this is kind of only on a desktop. If you hover over an element, it's going to get really big because this big class just increases the font size. And as soon as you take your mouse off, it's going to remove that class. Finally, if you click on the fourth paragraph, it's going to add a new paragraph to the page. So notice that I'm using the after function, not the append function, or else I'd have paragraphs within paragraphs within paragraphs. Okay. So now if I tap this first element, it's going to fade away. If I actually tap it. So there it goes. So it just faded away because I gave it that argument of slow. If I tap the second element, we notice that we changed its background color and its font color to red, which is pretty unreadable. And if I tap this last element, we're going to keep adding paragraphs to the page. So there we have new paragraph added every time I tapped it. So that's a brief primer on jQuery. Any questions on any of that or any other things you'd like to do in jQuery? It's an extremely useful library, and I would definitely recommend checking it out instead of writing everything in pure JavaScript. While that's useful, it's very, very tedious. So now for mobile DOM events. So WebKit defines a bunch of events that are specific to touch devices. So we looked at that click event, and that's not really applicable on a web device, on a mobile device. I'm sorry. So instead, we have these six mobile DOM events. So we have touch start, touch move, touch end, gesture start, gesture change, gesture end. Why it's touch move and gesture change, I'm not quite sure, but it should be either touch change or gesture move or something. So touch start is going to fire any time that a single finger is placed on an element. Whenever that finger moves, the touch move is going to fire. So if I'm moving my finger around really fast on the screen, this is going to fire a lot. Not just once when it starts moving and once when it stops moving. And finally, the touch end, which is when the finger is removed from the element, whether it be taking it off the screen or as soon as you've put your finger on another part of the page. The gesture class of DOM events are for multi-touch. So gesture start fires as soon as multiple fingers are on the page. When you move those fingers around, gesture change is going to fire for every movement. And then gesture end is going to fire when there's no longer multiple fingers on an element. So we can also kind of detect what the user is doing as these events are fired. So as you'll notice before, in all of our event handlers, our function took an argument, and we just called it event. So that argument is automatically populated with a lot of cool stuff by jQuery that can tell us what's going on with the event. So here, the event property has an array called touches. And so that's going to be an array of touch objects representing all of the fingers that are currently touching an element. So one useful property of these touch objects is the page X and page Y, which is going to be the coordinates that the user is currently touching. There's also scale and rotation, which is really, really cool for multi-touch stuff. So these apply to the gesture class of events. Scale is going to be the pinch zoom. So when the gesture start fires, we have a scale of 1. So if the fingers start moving closer together, that scale is going to approach 0. And if, as the fingers are moved apart, the scale is going to get larger. So there's also rotation. So once I put my two fingers on an element and I start rotating them in a circle, this is going to be the number of degrees that were rotated since those two fingers were placed on an element. So an important thing to consider is when we're using jQuery's bind function. As of the time these slides were prepared, it currently wipes out these properties. It does, however, retain the browser's copy of that event object in a property called original event. So if we're using the bind function right now, later versions, including the current version of jQuery, might not apply to, but for jQuery 1.4.4 it does. We're going to say event.originalEvent.touches or .scale to avoid having these properties wiped out by jQuery. So let's take a look at cool events. So here's that document ready again. So this is not going to fire as soon as the page loads, but it will fire as soon as I increase the font. Okay. So everything inside of this function is going to fire as soon as all the DOM is loaded and parsed. And so here we're using each of these events. So here we're binding touch start, and we're just going to populate this little div with the current action that was triggered, and then some information, which is going to be the scale and the rotation. So here we're binding it just as if it were any other DOM event, except on gesture change, you'll notice I'm also displaying the values of e.originalEvent.scale as well as originalEvent.rotation. So what this looks like, okay. So here's my page. I just have this big green box. So as soon as I touch the box, you'll notice that that touch start immediately showed up. If you're using the click event, it's actually still going to work. However, there's going to be a delay. You'll notice that on an iPhone, when you're scrolling, the iPhone kind of is really good at detecting if you're scrolling through your music or actually clicked on a song. So the way it does that is it waits about 300 milliseconds and sees if the finger has moved again. So if you bind to click, that's going to work totally fine. Just be aware that there is going to be a delay of about 300 milliseconds and noticeable to the user, not detrimental, but certainly noticeable, between when the user taps on something and when that event handler fires. If you use this touch start, on the other hand, it's going to fire as soon as that the user puts their finger on an element. So here, if I touch it, now if I move it around the screen, my touch move is fired, take my finger off, touch end. So now if I put two fingers on the screen, you'll notice we have a scale and a rotation. Is that visible or? Okay. So right now I put my finger on this box, and if I push my fingers closer together, you notice my scale has gone down from 1 to about 0.6. If I bring them apart, my scale is now 1.3. So this can be really easily used to simulate pinch zoom on your web page, on your web app. You can just read off this scale value and then multiply whatever it is you want to resize by the scale value, or you know, use some other constant in there. Now if I rotate my fingers, you'll notice the rotation is going up. So I've rotated my fingers about 90 degrees, and my rotation is 96 point a lot of things. So that's really cool. So you can totally simulate all the cool multi-touch stuff that a lot of the native apps do using purely a web app in these mobile DOM events. So that's all I have for you today. Don't forget about my feedback URL at myname.com/e76/feedback. Do feel free to give me some criticism. Good luck on your projects as they are released. I'll be posting these slides and all of my source code examples to the cs76.net webpage. And do feel free to email help@cs76.net or post to help.cs76.net with any questions you may have as the week goes on. I'll see you next week.